And Tyler Friel in for Scott Briggs here at this moment. And we are really a pleasure to be joined on the line by Dr. Amish Adulja. He is a senior scholar with Johns Hopkins University, an expert in infectious disease, and also a native of Butler, Pennsylvania. Dr. Adulja joins us rather by telephone. Thanks for taking the time and good morning.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
So you are a Butler native. If you could let our listeners know and maybe take us back to your childhood here in Butler and, you know, just growing up in the area and what it was like.
So, yeah, I am a Butler native. I moved there from Philadelphia when I was probably 1.5 years old. Both my parents were physicians in the Butler area, and I went to all of the Butler schools. I went to Butler Catholic from K through 8, and then Butler High School, class of 1993. I lived first in Butler Township and then in Franklin Township, the Mount Chestnut area, and my parents still live in Penn Township, and I'm still on staff at Butler Hospital, so I do work there a few times per month to keep my hand at the local hospital. And, you know, I think Butler was an interesting place to grow up. Most of my closest friends are still from Butler. And, I'm back usually at least once a week for some reason or another.
And, you know, did you know at the time, the interest in the medical field, you know, was that something that you were interested in while you were in high school, elementary school, or is that something that developed later on?
Because both my parents were doctors, it was something that I was exposed to basically since I was born, and so it was something very natural. I didn't initially want to completely do medicine. It was always something in my head. I like science. I liked infectious disease. The book that I used to read so much when I was a child was a book about Louis Pasteur and the discovery of the rabies vaccine. And I remember growing up also during the first days of the HIV/AIDS pandemic and in learning about that in school and being really fascinated by that virus. But I went off to Carnegie Mellon, and I was kind of a finance type of person for a while, but I had done so many science classes that one day it just kind of clicked in my head that I wanted to go into medicine, and I kind of made a shift and went that way. But it was always something that I was fascinated with because of all the discovery and the detective work, especially when it comes to infectious disease.
And as I was going to ask, is that what led you down the infectious disease path? Because it is a very complex field, I would have to imagine.
Definitely. I think that just when you look at all the different types of medicine and all the different aspects of it, the part I liked the most was figuring things out. And when it comes to infectious disease, it's not just it's not so simple always to make a diagnosis. You've got to figure out, what did this patient do? Who are they around? Where did they travel? What kind of pets do they have? What kind of hobbies do they have? And that's really only infectious disease that really puts that all together. And infectious disease has so many other elements, and we're all seeing it now with the pandemic, that an infectious disease emergency or a pandemic or an epidemic has cascading impacts on all aspects of society, with repercussions in politics and economics. So it really is something that kind of integrates everything in the world, at least in my mind, and that makes it very, very fascinating and intellectually stimulating.
And I think, in gearing our thoughts here toward the current pandemic, and obviously you're involved still with the Butler area, Butler Health System, you know, I think it's been fascinating to watch this pandemic evolve from, you know, its impact on urban areas like New York City, you know, last spring, to the impact on rural areas like Butler here, especially over the past couple of months. What has been the conversations and discussions amongst the infectious disease community about how this impacts different areas at different times and at different levels?
So most of us in the field knew that what was happening in the spring in New York City was not going to be extrapolable to the rest of the country. But that didn't mean that the rest of the country wasn't going to have its own experience with the virus. It was just going to be of a different flavor and on a different time frame, because the virus was kind of moving asynchronously across the country, and there are different demographic features, different geographic features, such as population density, how people get around. All of that plays a role in how they were going to be hit. But when you look at a virus like SARS-CoV-2, the cause of COVID-19, and it's an efficiently spreading respiratory virus that has a lot of people with mild symptoms or are pre-symptomatic who can then spread it to others, that basically tells you that no corner of the earth is going to be spared from this. And it is important to get ready. And if you're being spared early, it means that you should take that time to develop a public health infrastructure to be able to deal with cases when they inevitably come to your doorstep. And if you go back over 100 years and think about the 1918 Spanish influenza, Butler wasn't spared that time. I spent some time trying to research a little bit of the what happened in Butler a while ago, and there's a mass grave in Winfield Township from immigrant workers who just died. There were issues at the hospital at that time. So I think it's important to remember that even if you're in a rural area, you may not get hit as quickly or as fast as a metropolitan area or a megacity like New York City, but you are definitely going to feel the repercussions of a virus like this. And I think that's why it was important. And I do think that Butler Health System did a very good job with trying to prepare, getting people ready, talking to the public, and making sure that they had the resources to be able to care for the community.
And we've seen, I would argue, a significant decline in hospitalizations at their peak at Butler Health System, Butler Memorial Hospital, ranging close to 60 patients being treated for COVID at that time. That number now down to 22 as of Monday. What is your view of where we are currently? It seems like cases are going down, hospitalizations are going down. What is the current impact of COVID-19 in Western Pennsylvania and in the Butler County community?
We are seeing a little bit of an ebb, and it may be that people's travel patterns have kind of normalized after Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. And this is a national trend that we're seeing, with hospitalizations now below 100,000, around 80-something thousand in the United States as a whole. The number of deaths is still over 1,000, but the number of cases are falling as well. All of that is good news, but the question I have is how sustainable that is, because we do know that the UK variant, which is a variant of this coronavirus that spreads more efficiently, is making its way across the United States, and it's doubling every 10 days. And we know it's in Pennsylvania. We know it's everywhere. And that may be something that upsets this kind of ebb that we have, and we may see an upswing in cases and hospitalizations again. So really right now it is a race between getting vaccine into people's arms in these new variants. So I think that right now it seems that we're doing better, but we're still at a very high level. It's kind of like a flood, and the floodwaters have come down, but we're still in a flood. So it's not something that we can be complacent about. And then we have to be ready to redouble our efforts if this variant takes hold. And just simply by the laws of Darwinian evolution, it will become the dominant strain. It has everywhere else it's been, and it is making great incursions in the United States, and I think that's going to be something that's going to drive cases up if we don't get vaccine into people's arms fast enough.
And let's talk about vaccine distribution, because there have been some issues, bottleneck issues in various parts of this process, but definitely increasing in pace, you know, here in Butler County, at least according to the State Department of Health, over 18,000 people receiving at least one shot of the COVID-19 vaccine. Where are we in that process? What do you expect supply to look like, even within the next 2 weeks? Has there been any movement into clarifying? Because one of the, you know, things we hear from Butler Health System is that they don't know the amount that they're going to be allotted to on a week-to-week basis. So would a chance of being able to know that number help this process along?
It would completely help the process. What health systems like Butler need is predictability, because that predictability allows them to schedule appointments. That allows them to move through the priority groups. And if you don't have that predictability, you run the chance of having to cancel appointments, overbooking, all of those types of problems that we don't want to have. And I think what we're seeing is a problem at the federal level, a problem at the state level, that there is a lot of opacity into what the supply chain looks like. I think it is going to get better as we move closer to spring and into summer. But right now, I think it's very tight, and it's very hard to know exactly what's going to happen, and it's not really being matched very well to where the needs are. And I think that this is something that we predicted would happen, because it happened back in 2009 during the last pandemic, the H1N1 influenza pandemic, where there was a lot of confusion about when doses were going to arrive and how many were going to arrive, and the same type of thing is happening again. And I think this really goes to the fact that the federal government basically abdicated its responsibility here and left it to the states, and the states were not in a position to be able to do this very well, because these health departments are chronically under-resourced. They are the same people running testing sites. They are the same people doing case investigations and contact tracing, and now they have to run a vaccine campaign. And we really only saw the funding come through over the Christmas weekend, when this should have been planned for months ago, because all of us in the field were clamoring for this, because we knew it was going to be the biggest public health effort that the United States ever engaged in, a Herculean effort to get vaccine into people's arms. And a vaccine that sits in the shelves is not the same thing as a vaccination in someone's arm.
And, you know, I think Butler is lucky to have a health provider like Butler Health System that has the capacity to operate this because, you know, unlike Allegheny County in Philadelphia, you know, there is no local Department of Health. What is the challenge for the State Department of Health to get these vaccinations into even more rural communities? I mean, Butler's rural, but, you know, areas like Clarion County, you know, Venango, things like that. Where is the biggest challenge for the State Department of Health to help out these rural areas?
The challenge is the fact that these vaccines are not easy to give. They have the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines both have certain cold storage requirements that are difficult, so they're very hard to bring closer to the patient. You can't just drive around easily with them. You need to have them make sure that temperatures are maintained. You only have a certain amount of time once a vial has been opened or once it's kept at room temperature to get it into someone's arms. That makes it very difficult in a rural area. And I do think the Biden plan to have mobile vaccination units, to use the National Guard, to use the military, is one way to do this. I think you can also partner with drug stores, including not just the big CVS, Walgreen types or Rite Aid, these big chains, but also small independent pharmacies, which is how West Virginia basically was so successful, by using those independent drug stores to be able to get vaccine into people's arms. Primary care physicians, all of that's going to be really important. I do think this will get better once the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which we anticipate will be approved maybe in the next coming weeks, is around, because that is a single-dose vaccine. It doesn't have those cold requirements the way the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines do. You don't have to sit there for 15 minutes after you get it because of the allergic reaction issue. All of that is a little bit better, which will be something that can allow the vaccine to scale more and be closer to the actual person getting vaccinated. So I do think it's going to get better, but it's going to take some time.
And we're talking with Dr. Amish Abdulja. He is a senior scholar with Johns Hopkins and a Butler native. You talk about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and, you know, some of the promise that it can bring. I was listening to former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb talk about potentially there being a not supply issue but demand issue by the time you get to April, you know, late April, because of the amount of vaccine that will be on the market. Do you foresee that being a problem by late spring, that there just frankly aren't enough people willing to take the vaccine even though it's available?
Unfortunately, I think that's going to be the case. Right now we're in these priority groups where people like me who are a healthcare worker or nursing home residents or people that are older with comorbidities, they really want the vaccine because they know what COVID-19 can do to them. But when you're talking about vaccinating more of the general population that don't have high risk factors, that's when vaccine hesitancy is going to really play a role. So I do think we have to spend a lot of time trying to detail to people what the benefits of this vaccine will be and how it is going to be the path to normalcy, and that getting to herd immunity will be something that assures this virus is unable to really cause the same type of public health emergency that it has. However, I do think we will start to see, you know, striking impact of the vaccine in terms of when we start walking through hospitals. Once we get our vulnerable populations vaccinated, we won't see the hospitals cluttered with COVID-19 patients. We won't see hospitals worrying about their staffing and their personal protective equipment on a day-to-day basis. And I think that will give people the idea that this vaccine really is game-changing and should be something that they should want.
I want to talk to just about, I think, the public health challenge, because I was talking about this with my family. When that vaccine does become readily available and you have a group of people who have been vaccinated and, you know, with the appropriate time amount, how do you, as a Department of Health, you know, a public health official, try to determine the balance between mitigation efforts and, you know, getting vaccines in arms? And, you know, the argument to me, at least that I find, is that there would be this group of vaccinated people who feel like they have a little bit more freedom to maybe go to a restaurant and bar, but that may not be the State Department of Health may be hesitant to expand occupancy of a restaurant and bar because it's not safe. How do you balance, you know, loosening your mitigation efforts while there are still a, you know, group of people who are or haven't taken the vaccine?
The key thing to me is going to be getting the vulnerable populations protected, because you have to remember that COVID-19 is not going to be eradicated. This is going to be another seasonal coronavirus. Remember, there are four other coronaviruses that cause about 25% of our common colds. This is going to be the fifth one. Our goal with the vaccine is really to tame it, to defang it, so that it can never cause a public health emergency, so it can never put a hospital into crisis, so it can never kill at this rate. And once we get nursing home residents vaccinated, once we get those probably above the age of 65 vaccinated and some of the younger high-risk individuals, then I think we're in a different position. And I do think you're going to see state health departments start to think about lifting capacity restrictions, even if we haven't reached herd immunity, because the virus will not be something that can cause a hospital to go under because of the sheer number of patients. And I think that's what we're going to get as a society. And I think we have to get away from this notion that we can get COVID to zero. That's just not going to happen with a virus like this. This is here. It's with us. It's going to be an infectious disease threat we face, but it's not going to be something that can ever cause a widespread outbreak the way it has now. And I think that's what will change. So I think that's the important thing, is that it's getting the vulnerable populations vaccinated, because that's what flattening the curve was all about. It was not about getting it to zero. It was about being below hospital capacity. And the vaccine, because the vaccine is so effective against preventing hospitalization, we will start to see those benefits as we get our vulnerable populations, those who usually end up in the hospital, vaccinated.
I don't want to put you in the prediction business, but there's a lot of people wondering what this summer and what this fall is going to look like. If you were to have to make an educated guess here in early February, you know, what people's summer and fall would look like, what would be your speculation?
I suspect that by late summer, things will be very close to normal. It'll be a new normal where people are much more worried about being around crowds, and there may be still people that want to wear masks because they see the benefit of them. But I think by late summer, we'll be well into the vaccination program. I think our hospitals will not be under any kind of crisis conditions anymore. COVID-19 will still be causing cases. You'll still hear about it. It will still be an issue, but it won't be one that's a public health emergency any longer. And hopefully by fall, everything will be as close to normal as it's going to be, and that we're already moving on to second-generation vaccines that are even better than our first-generation vaccines.
And that's what I do want to circle around, because there's been talks about booster shots, things like that. So, you know, if you're somebody that has received a vaccination for COVID-19, you know, is there the potential for you come September, come October, that you may need a booster shot to help deal with different variants of COVID-19?
That's an open question right now. We do know that there are variants. There's three or so that we're really tracking, and specifically the South African and Brazilian variants are ones that may be something that the vaccine, at least some vaccines, have a hard time with. We don't know how well they fare against the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. The early data says that the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines look okay against the South African and Brazilian variant, whereas the Johnson & Johnson and the Novavax and AstraZeneca vaccines, which aren't available yet in the United States, may not do as well. So I think it may depend upon which vaccine you get. And I think it's going to be prudent to make new vaccines in case there is a need for that. But I think it's still too early to know whether or not we're going to need boosters and exactly what interval those boosters are going to be needed. Because again, even with those new variants, all of these vaccines prevent what matters. They prevent serious disease, they prevent hospitalization, and they prevent death. So that's really going to be the key, is how we kind of gauge, is that enough, or do we want to have a better vaccine that prevents more symptomatic disease, even if this isn't a disease that hospitalizes people at the rate that it does anymore?
We're chatting with Dr. Amish Adulja. He is a senior scholar with Johns Hopkins University, also an expert in infectious disease and a Butler native. Was there a Butler hangout of choice for you while growing up? What was the place to hang out with friends when you were growing up?
So I was, and I'm still a skateboarder, so we often would skateboard downtown. There was a place underneath the South Main Street Bridge, then called ECOS, where we would skateboard. It was kind of a parking lot that had all these slopes there. So I hung out there a lot. I would say also at the Clearview Mall. It was the heyday of the malls in the 1980s, so the Burger King parking lot, which now is a McDonald's, that was a place where people hung out for some unknown reason. Aladdin's Castle was an arcade at the Clearview Mall. There was another arcade at the Butler Mall, which no longer exists, called Americade. Those are all places to hang out. There also the Pizza Hut on Cunningham Street after football games was something that people did in the 1980s, which seems so long ago.
That's what I heard. That was the hangout of choice after football games. So hopefully one day we'll be able, and it sounds like that'll be sooner rather than later, we'll be able to hang out at a Pizza Hut again.
Yeah, hopefully.
Dr. Adulja, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it. Best of luck. And like I said, thanks for joining your hometown radio station.
Anytime. Thank you.